Up next is The Conversation.
Yeah, yeah.
You're the boss.
Thank you. Wow, really? Interesting. What an opportunity. Moving in compelling words, David, I really, every time I hear you speak, it's always so interesting for me, you know, as somebody that believes in dragons and demons. I'll say this, though, that you know, when we look at the partnership that is so necessary between traditional ecological knowledge and Western science in terms of targeting, you know, global crises like the end of the era of cheap energy and the loss of natural capital to sustain this insane industrial scientific experiment of the free market and, of course, climate change. I think your words really resonate with me. You know, one thing that I would add to the list of fundamentally sacred things that we need to protect, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, of course, are, you know, indigenous peoples in general and our language. And the reason I bring this up is because as you went through the list of water and the biosphere, what we refer to as the sacred, you know, I was reminded of some words that I heard from a storyteller by the name of Simon Bracope. His brother actually lives in Tesuki Pueblo. And he wrote once in a writing that he put that, you know, across the world there are 350 million indigenous peoples. They are concentrated in the places where the most purest water still exists, where the ecology is still healthy. You know, these are the places that our people are making their last stand. And that every time an indigenous language is lost, that it's like the burning of the library at Alexandria. And we lose an incredibly sophisticated understanding of the ecology of that one particular place that Creator put our people. Because as oral languages, you know, we have no written history. So our very words, our songs, our hunting and gathering practices, our agricultural practices, are vessels of our collective knowledge in terms of how to, you know, be a part of that sacred circle of life instead of separate and above it, controlling it. And so, you know, with that, I just wondered, what are your thoughts on that as we move into this time of extremes, you know, extreme energy, extreme climate change, extreme war? You know, where do the indigenous peoples come in, you know, and what are your thoughts on their role in this process of building the world's largest social movement?
They're at absolute the forefront of the whole movement. I didn't say at the beginning, I normally do, that everything I'm talking about has really been taught to me by First Nations people in Canada, Aboriginal people around the world. I've been a student ever since I began to realize that our paradigm, the one that I was really profoundly influenced by, was scientific reductionism. I was trained as a geneticist. As a geneticist, I was focusing on the DNA and chromosomes of fruit flies. I couldn't care less about fruit flies or where they lived. We used to call them flying bags of chromosomes. And we used to, we were interested in focusing because the reductionist assumption is that if you focus on bits and pieces of nature, then eventually, if enough parts are understood, we can fit them back together like a giant jigsaw puzzle or a clockwork mechanism. Mm-hmm. And what Rachel Carson did was she just banged me on the head when I read that book, because it said, yeah, scientists, you're very clever. You can make DDT and show it kills insects. But the lab is not the real world. You're not studying a miniature replica of the real world. You're studying an artifact. Mm-hmm. Because in the real world, it rains. The sun shines, at night falls, wind blows. You spray to kill insects in a field, and you end up affecting fish and birds and human beings. And that really was a recognition of the enormous, profound limitation of the reductionist approach. Yeah. And for me, it was a real dilemma until I came and met the Haida people in what used to be called the Queen Charlotte Islands, just off the panhandle of Alaska. And there they taught me that you are who you are. You are created by the birds and the trees and the water and the air. And all of that is what makes you who you are and in that place. Mm-hmm. And as you say, language is a huge part of that recognition of a lot of the ideas, the principles of that place. That knowledge is priceless and irreplaceable mm-hmm. by science. Mm-hmm. And I grieve at every loss of a language mm-hmm. because of what has been built over thousands of years of observation and experience is lost when you lose that language and that culture. And yet, if you look at the west coast of British Columbia, there are nine nations mm-hmm. through whose territory the government wants to build a pipeline from the Alberta tar sands. Now, these nations are unbelievably poor, these villages. And when you visit them, the first thing they'll say is, look, we've got chronic high levels of unemployment. We need jobs. We need community economic development. Mm-hmm. You can bet Enbridge has offered them millions of dollars to let them build the pipeline through their territory.
One-tenth stake.
And not one nation has said yes. So what is that telling? What is that telling us? That the message to me is there are things far more valuable than money. Mm-hmm. Their territory, their culture, their history, their language is not for sale. Mm-hmm. And I thank those remnants that are there. I thank them. I thank you, because we're gonna. You know, after all that's been done to Indigenous people around the world. I believe we go back to you and say, teach us. Teach us how to make that shift.
Well, absolutely. I mean, you know, as we just talked backstage, you know, about what we would talk about here, and of course, you know, inspired by your presentation and that, one thing we did agree on was that, you know, we need to flip the leadership of these social movements. You know, we need to lift up traditional ecological knowledge. We need to lift up Indigenous peoples to the forefront of the movement. You know, I would also put into that, you know, it is these times and these problems we face. I think it's going to take a little pinch of Western science, a little pinch of traditional ecological knowledge, and of course, the blessing of the great mystery to get to that next place. But I have faith. You know, you talked in your presentation about happiness-based gross domestic, you know, product. You talked about Bataan. Gross domestic happiness. You know, and this is something I think that, you know, we at the Indigenous Environmental Network and the hundreds of communities that we work with, that we often talk about, you know, and not just to our own people, but to everybody that we meet in terms of our allies. And you know, the last 20 years of our work has really been about, you know, trying to create space for people to reevaluate what has been damaged most by this economy, by capitalism, you know, by this emptiness that we're filled with and that we try to fill with products, you know. And, you know, I wanted to know, you know, would you say that what you're talking about is about reevaluating our relationship to the sacredness of Mother Earth?
Absolutely. But, you know, you've had hundreds of years of occupation and colonization. Mm-hmm. So that, of course, a lot of Aboriginal people have bought into mm-hmm. what the dominant society says. So there's a constant, you know, I tend to look to the elders mm-hmm. as the residue of culture that remains. They're mm-hmm. still the keepers, mm-hmm. but they're diminishing in numbers, and often for various nations and tribes, there's got to be a rediscovery from within the community as well mm-hmm. about those values. I wrote a book called The Wisdom of the Elders. Mm-hmm. And what it was an attempt to show that Indigenous knowledge is completely congruent with the latest cutting-edge science. Mm-hmm. That these are not exclusive areas mm-hmm. or in conflict. They are congruous. I wanted to give credibility, greater credibility, to this knowledge. And when I toured Canada with this book, I was shocked because half my audiences were Native people. And young kids would come to me and say, you know, I am so glad to see this book because you're telling me that the things my granny was telling me, those are important. And yeah. they have to rediscover the value because they themselves, the young people, are not putting as much faith or weight on what they're told by their elders.
Well, you actually flew up to northern Manitoba with one of my staffers during that tour, so that was a really great contribution. You know, you talked about the solutions that we need to come up with, you know, in terms of reevaluating, you know, what is our values, you know, and for me, when I travel and I talk to people and you know, try to inspire them to take action, you know, I talk a lot about extreme energy and I talk about climate change and, of course, the Canadian tar sands. And I spent a long time in the North Slope in Alaska working with the Gwech'en on Anwar as well and seen the patterns, you know, of the same neo-colonial kind of waves coming into our territories, you know, our indigenous people's territories. And I wanted to get your thoughts on today's movement. You know, you labeled yourself in this as, you know, being somebody that has been a fighter for many, many decades in the environmental movement. And as a young person, you know, something that I've observed and that I've been a part of being an architect of is trying to facilitate convergence between social movements and trying to break down the silos. And of course, a lot of that is coming from my own teachings from my elders about the interconnectedness of life, the interconnectedness of our communities, about these ridiculous medicine lines they call borders and how Mother Earth don't give a rat's ass about that. And, you know, there's been mass actions against the tar sands. You know, over 2,000 people arrested at the White House, the largest act of civil disobedience since the Vietnam War on the steps of the White House over the Canadian tar sands. Subsequently, a month later, 12,000 people surrounded the White House again, five rows deep, shoulder to shoulder. A month later, 2,000 people on the steps of our own Canadian Parliament with over 200 people that got arrested protesting the tar sands. 3 weeks ago, Victoria, the Parliament of British Columbia, 7,000 people converged, you know, on the lawn there in Victoria protesting the pipelines and the tankers in BC, the tar sands tankers and pipelines. A few days later after that, thousands of people in 64 municipalities in British Columbia took action in streets in all the communities all across BC and First Nations and non-Native communities alike. And so, as somebody that has kind of seen it all, you know, what I'm curious about, you know, is that when I talk about climate change, you know, I talk about it as a global issue that's rooted in social inequity. And I describe it, especially to young people, as the civil rights issue of our generation, you know. And, you know, quite often when I talk about social movement change theory, I talk about the importance of being rooted in an anti-colonial, anti-racist, anti-oppression framework, and that those agreements need to be made on the forefront because of the fact that in my youth, I've seen so many great coalitions fail because of these systems of oppression that pop up and just fracture everything. And so I wanted to get your thoughts on, you know, this diversity of tactics that has emerged, civil disobedience, like nonviolent direct action, lobbying, litigation, you know, all of these different pieces. And what are your thoughts on that? Do we escalate?
You've just recited what to me is a pretty impressive list of demonstrations, arrests, and so on. But, I mean, we have to be brutally frank. How much of an impact did 2,000 people have in this country? Did you ever hear a word mm-hmm. from either Obama or Romney mm-hmm. about the issue of climate change or the fact that Americans are caught up? I wonder how many people in the audience have ever heard about these demonstrations and arrests going on in Canada. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I just think if you're talking about a mass movement, it hasn't happened yet. Mm-hmm. And I believe that, you know, I was one of the signatories of the call for people to indulge in civil disobedience in Victoria. Mm-hmm. And I think it's going to be much more than that. But we've got to take this crisis seriously. Now, I'm encouraged by the fact that Mr. Obama, a day later, has now mentioned climate a number of times. So, mm-hmm. you know, at least he's kind of put it back on the agenda. But let me say, I think environmentalism has failed as a movement because it's become a kind of specialty. It's being led by people in the environmental movement. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of young people come to me and say, David, how do I become an environmentalist? I want to save the planet. And I say, well, first of all, the planet isn't in any trouble. Don't worry about the planet. The planet's going to do fine. But then I say, environmentalism is not a discipline or a specialty. Environmentalism is a way of seeing the world. And I say, follow your heart. What do you like to do? Because we need garage mechanics and plumbers and carpenters and teachers and doctors, and we need everybody to see the world through that lens. It's not a specialty. What we have failed in the environmental movement is to embrace a much broader spectrum of society. You see, to me, someone who's hungry and comes across an edible plant or animal is not going to go, oh, I better consult the red list and see if this is an endangered. They're going to kill it and eat it. I would.
Yeah.
So if you don't deal with hunger and poverty, forget about the environment. Hunger and poverty are my issue.
Well, see.
And it's the same for how people live. If you have chronic high levels of unemployment, if you live in a society where there's no chance for justice or greater equity or security, if you're constantly threatened with genocide, terror, or war, you're under threat and you have priorities that are not about the environment. So those are our issues.
Well, last we ran into each other. I seen you and you were with Severn, your daughter, and the newest grandchild who had the best hair, I just got to say. Just curly, curly hair, chubby, chubby cheeks. And we were outside the Rio Center at the Earth Summit in Rio, the third Earth Summit. And, you know, you bring up hunger and poverty. And, of course, Cargill and Monsanto have thoughts on hunger and poverty, as do Big Oil, and as do, you know, organizations like the World Bank and the investors in the World Bank, like G8 countries. And, you know, it's interesting when we look at what happened at Earth Summit and the whole launching of this new economic paradigm, this green economy, and programs like the World Bank REDS initiative, which, of course, is a very controversial program. Some people are for it, some people are against it.
REDS is.
Yeah, REDS stands for Reducing Emissions Through Degradation and Deforestation, and it's a forest offsets initiative that the World Bank has put on the table. And there are a lot of indigenous peoples and forest-dependent peoples, particularly in the global south where the World Bank operates, that see this as nothing more than a privatization scheme aimed at privatizing over 66 million indigenous peoples and forest-dependent peoples' lands to become commodities to be bought and sold and traded on the International Carbon Facility of the World Bank. Now, up north in places like the tar sands, where Cree and Dene and Métis people continue to live off the land, but in a very under severe stress because of the immensity of the project, the incredible contamination that's happening on a regional level, are concerned also about these types of market-based approaches to mitigating climate change, because they'll actually enable countries like Canada, who invest in the World Bank, to say, hey, we just planted 1 million trees in Uganda. Let's expand the tar sands. And so, you know, I think that what's so insidious about this green economy thing is that the way they're selling it to people around the world and the way they're selling it to indigenous peoples in the South is, not only are we going to stop climate change, but we're also going to pay you to continue to take care of your forests. What they don't tell them, though, is that those forests could potentially be cut down and palm trees could be planted, or sugar cane, or they don't talk about necessarily biodiversity in the mix. And they also don't talk about the fact that the World Bank has a long history of using military force to remove people from their lands for clean projects. And the Kalahari Wind Project is a perfect example. It was a clean development mechanism project. 300 people got killed to basically get them out of the way for a massive wind farm that would power up a gold mine. And this is World Bank, you know. So what I'm wondering from you then is, what are your thoughts on, as this green economy propaganda emerges, how do we deal with the immense force that, you know, the Monsantos, the Cargills, the Big Oil, King Coal, are continuing to push out there? Because when I look at the green economy that has emerged, it's just patchwork on the Titanic. You know, and the freaking boat should never have been built in the first place. And in my opinion, we just got to let that shit sink. So, you know.
Well, I think I agree that it's the economic system itself. So you can have all kinds of good examples of companies, Patagonia, Ben & Jerry's, The Body Shop, Interface Carpets, that are trying to do the right thing, to reduce their footprint and not be so destructive. But they're still stuck in the same economic paradigm. If they don't have a business plan in which you're continuing to grow, you're considered dying. Mm-hmm. You know, growth is built into these plans as necessities. Mm-hmm. So you're stuck with a system that is based on a cancerous model of development, constant growth, and which essentially ignores the services that nature actually performs to keep the planet healthy and survival and livable for us. So there are fundamental flaws in the economic system. And to me, the challenge is getting that thing back into some kind of congruence with the actual places where we live mm-hmm. on the planet. How do you do that? Well, you can try these mechanisms, which I agree with you. I think that carbon offsets, and I have to admit, I fly a lot. Mm-hmm. I buy gold-plated carbon offsets, mm-hmm. which is not reducing my carbon emissions. Mm-hmm. It gives me a bit of salve to my conscience. I've got all kinds of ways to justify flying, but it's not reducing as I and everybody else has to do. Mm-hmm. But I think that there may be the opportunity to get the right things in place by having carbon offsets, but we have to ultimately confront the destructive economy itself. How do you do that? Well, to me, 2008 was the opportunity. Mm-hmm. We have to confront the fact that this economy can't keep growing forever. Now, I've been touring Canada with Jeff Rubin, mm-hmm. who was the senior economist with one of the major banks in Canada for 20 years. And he's just written a book called The End of Growth. And I'm, you know, ever since the Club of Rome came out with limits to growth, environmentalists have been running around saying you can't have an economy that grows forever. And people go, you're just a bloody environmentalist. What do you know about economics?
Right.
So I've been touring with Jeff, and he tells you, hey, it's come to an end. It ain't going to grow anymore. And then I can come along and say, okay, now let's start looking at what can we do. We need that crisis to confront the reality that this system is broke and it can't be fixed. I would have thought the United States is there.
Yeah.
Here's the biggest economy on the planet, and most of you, it is owned by China. I mean, if that doesn't have implications, I can't imagine.
Well, that's a perfect segue, actually, to my next question that I had for you, you know. And I mean, you say the economy is broke. I mean, I would push back, you know, respectfully and say that I think it's working just the way it was meant to. I think it was designed that way. It's a predator economy. It's a linear economic model. And, you know, we need something else. I agree with you on that. But I think it is, I often hear that the economy is broke. And, you know, I think it was designed that way. This is free market economics. It's cannibalistic. It's predatorial. And, you know, it is what it is.
Jeff Rubin's thesis is, as long as you've got cheap oil, the economy purrs like a kitten, runs beautifully. The minute that you get oil spiking, you run into trouble. Now, we've had a number of recessions in the past 40 years. Mm-hmm. Once in 1973 because OPEC deliberately turned off the spigots. And Americans should remember how frightening that was. In 2012, dollars, oil went up, gas went up to 100, oil went up to $150 a barrel. Mm-hmm. And you remember Americans lining up at the gas pump, and it was very scary. In a typical American fashion, people started shooting each other, lined up waiting to get their gas.
You know? Yeah.
That's the American solution. But he says that another time Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait mm-hmm. and set on fire half the wells, and you got a spike in price, and we went into a recession. Mm-hmm. And over again, those recessions have been induced because of war or deliberate turning down the tap. Yeah. This one is different. The price of oil is not going to go down. Mm-hmm. And the reason is we've got all of the easy-to-get oil. Mm-hmm. And now it's getting more and more extreme. We've got to go deeper and deeper into the ocean. We've got to go deeper and deeper into the soil. We've got to get tar sands, shale oil. We've got to go to obscure places like Venezuela, the Orinoco. And this oil is not coming down.
Well, they're approving tar sands projects in Utah, for crying out loud. The most water and energy intensive type of oil development in the desert. So, yeah, we're definitely living in extreme times. But I want to take this back real quick here to, you know, I guess I want to go up to a more 70,000 foot perspective. You know, as we talk about energy, as we talk about climate change, food security, you know, and all the inequities that are within that, you know, and everything else that we've brought up this evening that you've brought up, you know, and you just mentioned China. We know, especially when we look at countries like Germany, that when they say that we can't do it in terms of renewable energy, that they're just full of BS, you know, and that what we can't do is continue to consume in an American style, you know, American-centric style. But that the energy's there. The sun provides enough, the wind provides enough, the tides provide enough. There's been a lot of China bashing. I don't know how it is here in the U.S., but in Canada, there has been a lot of blame China stuff that's going on, that's bordering on...
I thought we're embracing China. We want them to invest in Canada and the tar sands.
Absolutely. Maybe, you know, private sector, big oil, for sure. But in terms of the climate debate, you know, I'm talking about our circles. Even in British Columbia, there's been some avatars on Facebook saying, stop the Chinese pipeline. And there's some accuracy to that with the new, you know, bilateral trade deal our prime minister signed with China, giving them the right to sue, you know, if they can't get their tar sands investments out of Alberta, you know, which is insane. But I wanted to ask you, though, you know, like when we look at the historical contribution to the global climate crisis and definitely the per capita contribution to climate, you know, Americans and Canadians, hands down, the worst. I mean, an average Canadian puts more CO2 in the atmosphere than an African family of 10, you know. And so what I wanted to know is, as we kind of confront internally things going on in the U.S. and in Canada, how do we avoid getting into these, what I perceive as borderline, you know, xenophobic kind of paintings of the BRIC countries, you know, India, Brazil, and China. These emerging economies, you know, because in my understanding, you know, the reason that they're using the dirty technologies they're using comes down fundamentally to a tech transfer issue. You know, technology wasn't transferred from the north. But maybe you have a different assumption. And I don't know. I mean, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, we had the explosion in Western economies because of technology and our exploitation of cheap energy. And we set the example for the rest of the world. Now, I was at Kyoto in 1997, and India and China were there. And everyone agreed, especially the industrialized countries. We had created the problem. It was our industrial growth and use of fossil fuels that had created the problem of climate change. We're producing more than can be absorbed. And it was our responsibility then, because in 1997, we were the major contributor, for us to cap our emissions and bring it down a tiny amount, 6%, mm-hmm. by 2012. Everyone agreed that the industrial countries would sign on, and countries like China, India, Brazil, Indonesia would be allowed to grow their economies and contribute, increase their production.
Contraction and convergence.
The minute Kyoto was over, in Canada, the argument went, wait a minute, what kind of an agreement is that? China and India aren't even in this agreement. It's not fair. We agreed, for God's sakes, at Kyoto, mm-hmm. that we would not include them. Mm-hmm. But we had to set the example. Then Canada's argument was, we're only 2% of global emissions. Yeah, but we're only 0.4% of global population. Don't you think, maybe we're a bit of overproducers? And we had all these arguments, and I kept saying, look, we're setting the example. Our economy now is beyond anything they know in India or China. Mm-hmm. And if we, the richest country in the world, can't say we're going to cap and bring it down, why should they even listen to us, for heaven's sakes? And, of course, it's suicidal if they don't listen and do something themselves. The reality is China is one of the leading countries in the green economy. Mm-hmm. They produce 9 out of 10 solar panels, becoming a global leader in windmill production. China sees not only the opportunity in the green economy, but the necessity, because they're killing hundreds of thousands of Chinese, which is still a drop in the bucket, but hundreds of thousands of Chinese through pollution. Mm-hmm. They got a real problem, environmental problem.
Absolutely, yeah. I mean, there's been mass protests actually in the region where the photovoltaics are being produced because of poisoning of the rivers. And, you know, I mean, it is a field of 10 factories lined up. It's just unbelievable. I want to bring us around full tilt. We are getting close to the end of the evening, but I want to bring us back to the rights of Mother Earth. You talked about Bolivia. You talked about Ecuador. You know, for us, I think so many indigenous peoples have been so inspired by evil, you know, being elected to lead, you know, a country. Sure, they're the poorest, but, you know, by what measure, you know? Definitely not by Bhutan's measure. But, you know, a year ago, Evo, along with a host of prominent environmentalists and environmental justice leaders, including our director from IEN, Tom Goldtooth, submitted the rights of Mother Earth to the United Nations. And I guess for me, I wanted to get some final thoughts from you. As we move into this era where in Ecuador and, you know, in places like Aotearoa, New Zealand, there are entities of the sacred, rivers, mountains, that are being given rights that humans have within the legal constructs of our society. You know, and the way I react to that is, what a great counterbalance to this BS corporate personhood stuff they got in America. You know... And one thing I just want to bring to you, you know, you bring up reductionism. And one thing that we deal with all the time as indigenous peoples is reductionism in the movement. People that say, you know, oh, we're all in this boat together, you know, yada, yada, yada. You know, and when we look at what's going on right now in New York City and who's, you know, still got no power, who's most vulnerable. When we did the same analysis of New Orleans, Hurricane Katrina and Rita, who's most vulnerable? You know, even with this last storm, there's not a mention of what happened in the Caribbean, you know, islands in that whole region, you know, from the same storm, you know, and the devastation there in our media. And so I bring up, I guess, you know, as we move into this time when we're trying to influence and raise up the rights of Mother Earth, what are your thoughts on the necessity and importance of the human rights-based approach within our current work? Because there are still many uneven playing fields and also disproportionate impacts when we talk about climate change, when we talk about extreme energy, you know, when we talk about, you know, what Monsanto and Cargill are doing to our food systems. There are communities which tend to be racialized, at least in North America, or communities in the South. Sure, there's some low-income white folks in there too in North America, but you know, when we talk about, you know, raising Native folks up to the forefront to lead the movement, I also think about all of our other communities that we've worked with through the civil rights movement and all these other things. And I just want to know, you know, where you sit, you know, as an elder of our movement, how do we keep that balance and not lose sight of the fact that there are still very real pieces in terms of trying to just have equality, you know, and try and flip that power paradigm.
Do we have 5 hours?
Just final thoughts.
Well, our foundation, which is a small organization, sees its next big project, well, it started now, is to try to get a constitutional amendment. And this is still an anthropocentric way of approaching it, but we're trying to enshrine the right to a healthy environment in our Constitution. And it sounds, you know, like it sounds like a motherhood issue, except when you look at what is a healthy environment. You can't have a healthy environment for people without Pachamama being healthy and flourishing. So it's a very subversive way, I think, of making us face the fact of our relationship with the rest of creation for our well-being. So this is one small initiative which I hope will become a big movement in Canada. And we want this to be as big a tent as possible. So as I say, a lot of these issues of social justice, of hunger and poverty, they've got to be in the tent with us, the right to a healthy environment. So that's one small way that we're approaching it. But quite frankly, I think if we can't bring this behemoth the global economy, if it doesn't somehow collapse, that's going to be the trigger to the really big changes. Mm-hmm. So we're still going to have to do it in bits and pieces wherever we are. I don't know much about it, but I'm intrigued by what's called in England the transition town movement.
I'm very familiar with transition towns.
Which is much more of a trying to become locally self-sufficient.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a lot of examples, too, in North America, like transition towns that are emerging. But yeah, the whole localization movement, I definitely am a big supporter of that as well. I'm afraid that our time for conversation is coming to an end, though, this evening. But I want to just say what a pleasure it is to share the stage with you and also with all of you here in Santa Fe. And I just want to express great thanks to our host, the Lannan Foundation, for giving Dr. Suzuki and I...
Thank you.
Dr. Suzuki, is there any website or Twitter feed that you want to let people know to go to?
Well, the David Suzuki Foundation is Google that and you'll find all you need.
For us, Indigenous Environmental Network, ienearth.org, Google Indigenous Environmental Network. We're on Facebook. We're on Twitter. We love the social media thing, so hit us up. And, we'll see you all in the streets.
Thank you.
You've been listening to a Lannan podcast. You can subscribe to our podcasts at podcast.lannan.org. In addition, the Lannan Audio Archives present similar programs by national and international writers, poets, and social activists at www.lannan.org. Listen to hundreds of hours of recorded programs from the likes of Seamus Haney, Joy Harjo, Eduardo Galeano, Arundhati Roy, Jim Harrison, Edwidge Danticat, and Noam Chomsky. New programs are added every month to both the podcasts and the audio archives.